You will no longer stand between me and my destiny.
But I will.
And the masters of the universe. I am Adam, Prince of Eternia and defender of the secrets of Castle Grayskull. This is Cringer, my fearless friend. Fabulous secret powers were revealed to me the day I held aloft my magic sword and said,
by the power of Grayskull!
Became the mighty Battle Cat, and I became He-Man, the most powerful man in the universe. Only three others share this secret. Our friends, the Sorceress, Man-at-Arms, and Orko. Together, we defend Castle Grayskull from the evil forces of Skeletor.
Welcome to another episode of I Have the Power, a He-Man podcast. As always, I'm your host, Adam, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Steven. Steven, how's it going?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Awesome. We have another guest. We're doing a lot of guest episodes lately. It's a special episode. We're going to do a review of the Master of the Universe live-action film, the studio-released version. Because last episode we did the fan film, so this time to celebrate the anniversary of the film, we are going to do a review of the 1987, right, Steven, film?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right. And so we brought on a fellow He-Man fan to join us, and that fan is Garrett Grev. Garrett, how are you?
Hey guys, I'm great. Thank you for having me on. I am. Yes, very excited to talk about the 1987 classic, Masters of the Universe. It's, one of my favorites. Brings me back every time I think about it.
Now, before we get into that, if people don't know who you are that are listening to the show, give us a little bit of background of where they might have heard you before.
So my Twitter account, I am at Garrett, W-A-T-O, G-A-R-R-E-T-W-A-T-O. And if anyone follows me or sees me, you know, in the Twitterverse, typically talking about Batman, Superman, or He-Man, it's Star Wars. And then a lot of fantasy football, American football, too. But the Batman stuff, I've been working with the guys over at Batman on Film and Bill Raimi there for about 3 years, doing comic book reviews, movie reviews, their podcasts and vlogs. That's probably where most people would have had some exposure to me. I review Justice League over at that site and Batman Superman. And I also got Bill, you know, the editor-in-chief over there, to let me review a He-Man title. It was Masters of the Universe versus Injustice. If you'd read those comic books, I got to review that line by Tim Seeley. I think that was 2 years ago already.
Yeah.
So a little bit of crossover between the two worlds on that one. That was a fun assignment to have.
Awesome. And as I always say, if you can find a fellow fan that is both a Batman and a He-Man fan, then you're in good company. If they're a fan of neither, run the other way.
We're
actually in the midst of, we just started reviewing the DC Universe versus Master of the Universe. So eventually we will get to the Injustice versus Master of the Universe one, but we're not there.
I'll be interested to see what you guys think about that. And I was actually really impressed with the storyline.
It felt like it could be some great work with the property.
Yeah, great work. The art, you know, Freddie Williams is great. And it was a story that seemed like it could have been, you know, kind of a cash grab and just, you know, banking solely on nostalgia. And I thought, you know, they had a really good through line for the story, and I enjoyed it a lot. So I'll look forward to what you guys have to say about that one.
Like, they've done a lot of, and that's a little small tangent here, but they've done a lot of miniseries with the Masters of the Universe at DC. And I'm like, can we get an ongoing back again? Like, I love the miniseries, don't get me wrong, but I get so into it, and then it's over, and I'm like, okay, I want more now. And then, so it's like, An ongoing would be nice.
Yeah, they seem DC seems to kind of have Masters of the Universe as their kind of go-to miniseries. That's just it seems like the way that editorially they've decided to handle it. But I agree, a ongoing title would be something I'd be very excited for.
I wonder if that's just that work. You know, it might work profits wise for them. Maybe they do better doing it like that. If they're an ongoing, maybe they think they'd dilute it or something like that.
Well, they had the ongoing, right? So
they did.
Well, maybe did it not do so well, and that's why maybe they do. He's like mini.
I have no idea, but it could. But it also could be how they work out things with Mattel, right? Because they have to license it.
Yeah.
Right.
Who knows when new shows come? Maybe they'll.
Oh yeah, I have no doubt about that. Once the new show.
When the film hit, eventually gets made.
When the film hits, and we're 95. If we could still see and read by then, we'll we might have something. But speaking of He-Man in general, Garrett, when did you get interested in the property? Like, when did it catch your eye? When did it?
Oh man, so I was an '80s baby, but a '90s kid. I had some older cousins that were really into Masters of the Universe, and I was huge. You know, obviously, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe from Filmation was on TV and largely probably, you know, in its reruns and syndication by the time I was old enough to catch it. But the toy waves were still out. You know, I think like the 87, 88 line of figures were sort of what I was really old enough to enjoy. But I had some of the, I had a lot of the older ones, and you could find, you know, for a long time, the you know, sort of first wave was in stores, and I would get those kind of a couple years after they were released. And the movie was right about when I was sort of in my prime, not prime, I hung onto it for a little longer, but I was at the right age for that to be old enough, you know, just old enough basically to go into the theater. And I'll save some of my thoughts around that, but I've got some young kids and kids that are older than I was when I went to go see that. And I'm not letting them watch Masters of the Universe, the live action movie, quite yet. So things were different in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then I always kind of stayed with it, you know. I just kind of loved and appreciated the characters. You know, through high school, I was definitely more of a DC Superman, Batman guy in general. And when I got to college, we lived out in the middle of nowhere in northern Minnesota and didn't have internet access because we were so far out of town, basically until I went to college. But in college, like one of the first things I did was like, you know, bored, let's Google. Or I don't think we weren't Googling back then, right? Yahoo asking Jeeves about
He-Man.
And then started reading up on He-Man.org and, you know, just kind of... have really enjoyed every iteration. And the fun thing about Masters of the Universe and He-Man is it's never fully left, you know, the public conscious, you know, through, so there's always been some sort of product offering. So it's interesting how you see guys that are, you know, younger than me as I get into my, you know, mid to late 30s here, and younger guys that, and girls that are into the property that found it through, you know, maybe the classics or maybe, you know, some of the video games, the Tapper games on your iPhone that came out a few years back. But yeah, I was there from the beginning, not beginning, but the original series and Mattel toys were how I found it.
Right. So speaking of the toys, I have to ask, what was your, I'm sure you had a bunch of them. So did you have a favorite of yours that you had when you were a kid that you just like, hung on to that thing for dear life and took it everywhere? And
I mean, well, first, you can't get any better than the original He-Man, so that was a huge one. But then like the two later figures that I remember just loving as a kid was Thunder Punch He-Man, you know, with the cap in the little backpack and the snap action to make the thunderous punch. I'm gonna say three: Terrorclaw Skeletor, and then Scareglow. I know he's kind of almost a cliche at this point because the vintage Motu figure collectors, like, he's got probably the highest market and everybody's chasing him. But I always thought that was just so cool back in the day. I was fascinated. He was one of the only characters I kept the card back for because I read it over and over again, and they worded his, like, short background very oddly. He said he was the well, now I'm going to forget exactly what it says. Terrifying ghost of Skeletor, which made me wonder as a kid, like, oh man, is this supposed to be when Skeletor died and came back as a ghost, or is this the ghost of Skeletor, meaning like of the side of Skeletor? And I just thought that was so interesting that I hung on to the card back. And back then, you know, we weren't buying as collectors; we're buying as kids. You rip the thing open as soon as you could get out.
Like,
right. But if I hung on to that one, so I was just intrigued by it.
Do you, now I have to ask this because I, if anybody who's listening to this show will listen to me, they probably think I'm whining, but I don't have any of my He-Man figures anymore. They went for a good cause, but you know, I still part of me still wishes I had some of them. But do you have any that you hung on to that you still have as a collector?
I have. If you ask my wife. far too many He-Man figures. So you know, I got to this point, I didn't for a long time, quite honestly. A few years ago, my mom was cleaning out you know, some of the stuff that she had hung on for me in storage, and brought down my childhood collection of toys. And I largely had, you know, what I had as a child. Some stuff had been broken and played with, you know, to the point where it's just like in pieces and had been tossed. Excuse me, but I had a lot of stuff, and I started researching it. My boys loved it. I've got four boys now. I think I maybe just had the two then, but they were.
I stopped at two.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a lot of energy at the Grub House. I'll say that. But my boys were just fascinated by it, and at the time, He-Man and Masters of the Universe, Filmation was on Netflix, so they got really into it, and I started, you know, looking into, not really understanding there was a big aftermarket for this stuff and collector's market, I started looking into what was for sale, and I started buying some stuff up. I sold some stuff, built some collections, resold those. Nice. Actually bought the computer I'm recording on right now with the profits of some of those sales. So I've got a full garage storage rack full of different lots of collections. I haven't sold a lot of stuff lately, but my wife is eager for me to clear out that corner of our guest bedroom. So
I will probably. All right, which one are you getting rid of next?
exactly right.
Whereas you're probably like, okay, which one am I bringing in next? And she's like, no. But yeah, no, I'm actually waiting for the new iterations of the animated series, so I at least can get. I know it won't be the same, but I can at least get some of the stuff. I'm not going to go crazy, but you know, a couple items that I'd love to have. So I'm eagerly waiting to see what they come out with, because some of the vintage stuff to get it back is quite hefty. So I'm kind of waiting eagerly to see what comes of it toy wise. But speaking of we've heard that we have two animated series on the way via Netflix. One is from Kevin Smith, which is going to be Revelations, I think it's called, right, Stephen?
Yeah, that's right.
I always want to say Revolution, but it's actually Revelation.
Yeah, it's Revelation, yeah.
And which is a sequel series. And then we have a 3D CG something or other version animation, which is an origin tale. So what are your thoughts on both? Like, what are you looking forward to? Are you hyped more for one than the other? How's your temperature on those things?
Man, you know, I can't say I'm more excited for one versus the other. I've always been a bit of a Kevin Smith fan, you know, back to his movies in the 90s and early 2000s. And, you know, I watched some of his more recent stuff. It you know, I think I still enjoy them. I'll put them that way. But and I really enjoy his podcasts, kind of the Smodcast Network. I was into a lot of their shows for a while, Hollywood Babylon. And, you know, I've always liked Kevin Smith. Yeah. So I'm interested to see what he'll do with the property. I know Mark Bernardin is working on that as well. And he's had the Fat Man on Batman and Fat Man Beyond podcast with Mark for quite some time. I think he's a pretty gifted storyteller. Sometimes, you know, Mark can get into analysis of what other writers should have done or other directors should have done that he thinks would be better, but I think he's got a good handle on how to tell stories. So
sure.
I'm interested in that it's a shorter format, you know, kind of a limited series. And then, like, super cool to see what they do with a new, what seems to be ongoing series. You know, She-Ra and Princesses of Power wasn't exactly my cup of tea. from a design standpoint. So I'll be interested to see if there's connective tissue between that and the new sort of retelling series. But mm-hmm. I might have just talked myself into saying I'm more excited for the sequel series. I think I might be. Yeah.
As I work. Well, that's coming first anyway, isn't it? So.
Yeah. Yeah, we're supposed to get that this year, I believe.
Yeah, because usually animation takes about a year to a year and a half from when it was announced, right? So it was announced last August, I think. So.
Yeah, and Kevin Smith said the other day he's watched about four or five of them, so there must be either already or nearly already.
If he wants to Google Drive us, I mean, we can watch him.
Yeah. Honest
opinion. So, but yeah, no, I remember when I both times when I heard about the first show, Steven had messaged me. I was actually getting on a plane to go on vacation, and I read his message. I'm like, wait, oh, they're doing a sequel series. Fantastic, can't wait. And then I let it go. I went on my vacation, came out, and you know, months went by. And I think it was November when you messaged me again, Steve, and said, there's another year. I said, wait,
oh, yeah, yeah.
And then I'm looking, I'm like, oh, this is different. I'm like, oh, we're getting two? I'm like, yeah, the sequel series has my attention because that's, you know, I grew up with the original. But also watch that I'm equally as excited for that. You want to give me more? It's like here's the analogy I'll use. I'll bring it back to Batman. It's like saying, all right, we have this Robert Pattinson movie coming, right, as Batman. And now we're getting Michael Keaton as well. It's like, I'm not going to say no to any of it.
Right.
Give it all to me. I'll take it all, and I'll be as happy as can be. So, yeah, well, it's...
And the voice cast for Revelations is outstanding. If you haven't, Google that and look at the cast of characters and actors, really talented voice actors, and I think it's going to be outstanding. And some Batman alum, so you're going to get Mark Hamill back, you get Kevin Conroy, so those guys are reunited. Bader,
I think Diedrich Bader is there too, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, it's going to be
a trifecta of Batman.
Yeah,
a lot of that going on, awesome. Which makes sense. Kevin's a big Bat fan.
So. Yeah, it's a no-brainer really when Kevin's involved. So yeah, I can't wait.
I love that he's bringing Alan Oppenheimer back as well.
You can't go wrong with that voice. But
even though his voice is it Mossman? I don't even know who Mossman is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, but no, I mean Alan Oppenheimer is. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, great voice.
A legend, right? So it's just I can't wait. Hopefully, we'll hear more. Soon. I think they're doing an online version of PowerCon, as last I checked. So I'm hoping we'll get some more news whenever that rolls around. And then the live action movie we'll touch on at the end after we've talked about the actual the only live action movie that was in quote unquote big budget format that we had to talk about. So let's get into that. Garrett, when you said you have some memories of actually seeing it in theaters. Like, what was your, if you can remember back, take us back, and what was your feeling when you heard of the movie or when you were approaching to go see it? Like, what was the hype around that for you?
Yeah, man. So I was preschool age, Garrett, and, you know, big He-Man fan. And, went to go see the movie in the theater. I remember it being a little bit scary for me because man, I kind of made a joke about the quote unquote big budget, but where they did spend money, I thought was effective. And Skeletor scared the heck out of me, man. As a kid, like Frank Langella and that performance and the makeup, just really, I thought was at that age, I was like, oh, this is like real life Skeletor, right? This is as real as it gets. And as a kid, I remember walking out of the theater and being really happy with it. And I still, I still have a lot of fond feelings towards the movie. But I don't remember being let down that it was on Earth. I remember wanting there to be more characters that I was familiar with from a villain standpoint. And I had, it's funny. My dad told me, like, I had a million questions and wanted him to explain to me, like, oh, so what happened to the sorceress? Like, I thought of the movie as a sequel to the cartoon at the time, which makes sense for a kid. Yeah. And I wanted to know what happened between the last cartoon episode that I saw and the live action movie. And, you know, where's Battle Cat? And how come Orko isn't there? And, you know, all the things that we know now are, you know, largely driven by budget. Yeah. And also trying to adapt the property kind of before the cartoon series came out. So I remember having some questions. I remember being a little bit scared, but I remember having an absolute blast with it.
Yeah, for me, and then I'll let you go, Stephen, but for me it was, I don't have vivid memories of seeing it in the theater, but my parents remind me that they took me, and the prevailing consensus was that I was pleased with it, and that Skeletor, as with you, scared me a little bit, but my prevailing concern at that time, according to my mother, was where was Battle Cat? That's all I wanted to know. Like, I was happy with everything else, but I needed to know where he was. And of course they had no answer. But years later I would find, oh, budget. They couldn't make that work. So I remember that I had seen it growing up, you know, in a couple of later years, right? I think it was on TV that I had really sort of paid attention to it. And I overall was really pleased with it. Even, on second and third viewing when I was younger, but, you know, a little older than I was at the time when it first came out. And, I mean, if you think about it, it gives you your basic, like, it checks most of the boxes when you think of an animated episode. We've got a battle between He-Man and Skeletor. His obsession is with taking over, you know, the power, and also getting into Castle Grayskull, which in this version, we're at a place where Skeletor is in control. He's basically won at this point, at the start of the film. He's on the verge of winning. Whereas in the cartoon, you think about it, we've never seen that. He's always, you know, trying to get into that damn castle.
Well, apart from that one we watched a while back.
Yeah.
We were a bit stunned, weren't we? He actually got in. We were like, what?
Well, I don't remember him getting in, but it's always trying to get into the castle. So you have that dynamic. You have Teela, you have Man-at-Arms, and then you have, in terms of Skeletor's main people, you have Evil-Lyn. And you have Beastman, which were, to me, were the two main, you know, adversaries that were partners of his. So I was never too broken up that the rest of the crew was all made for the film, essentially, right? So that never really bugged me. And the fact that it was on Earth back then, I didn't care. Like, if you ask me, at 37-year-old me, which is now, I'm like, well, I want a movie more focused on Eternia than going on Earth. But back then, I was fine with it.
I think I thought it was kind of fun. Like, yeah, you get to see these guys on Earth. I'm on Earth. That means, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, I could see back then, that young age, I mean, we could see them walking down the street. Like, the concept of it's a movie, it's, you know, those lines were still a little bit blurred. But I got to give the movie credit. You know, I think both, I think Man-at-Arms really liked the fried chicken. So I can't argue with that. Fried chicken is really good. So
he sure did. Never think when you're hungry.
Yeah, and it was terrible because I rewatched it last night and I'm like, crap, now I want fried chicken. But, you know.
Yeah, it's ribbed either way.
Taylor doesn't.
Yeah, she wasn't. She wasn't having it. Which I'm like,
what the hell does she think she's eating? That's what
I strongly disagree with you there. But no, so I thoroughly had fun with it. And I still do. And I realize that it's not the game changer in terms of, cinema, or more specifically, superhero cinema. It's like, it's not, it didn't raise the bar. It didn't, you know, do any of that stuff. But it was a fun hour and 44 minutes, and I think, like I said, it checked off a lot of the boxes that you would typically see in an episode of the animated series. So I had fun with it. Stephen, what about you?
Yeah, I was about 3 when it came out, so I didn't get to go see it, unfortunately, but my brother did. And the thing he remembers to this day always tells me is when Skeletor was, when he's walking in Castle Grayskull and he's like stamping his stuff down, he said that was so loud in the cinema that it made him jump. Now, that's what I remember him telling me about his experience. But I think I saw it on like VHS, and it must have been maybe 1990 or something, because I remember we had the VHS for Batman, and it had the promo for it, and it had that tagline, the Star Wars of the 80s, which I always thought The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi were the Star Wars of the 80s, but, you know.
Yeah, it's a bold claim.
Yeah, but you can see why. There's a lot of Star Wars comparisons in it. Isn't there? But, as a kid, I didn't care. I just wanted He-Man and Skeletor, and that's what I got, so I wasn't fussed at all. It didn't have loads of other characters in it. I honestly don't think I cared. And for me, Dolph Lundgren just looked like He-Man, so I was pretty pleased with him. And we're talking about Skeletor. Skeletor never scared me, but Karg did as a kid. And I used to have a recurring nightmare when he used to pull me down my bed. It was really freaky. I remember having this weird nightmare when I was a kid.
He was terrifying, you're right.
Yeah. But when you think about when you're a kid and you have a nightmare, it's pulling you down the side of your bed. That was quite freaky. But yeah, I just always loved this film. And like you say, Adam, maybe now you can see its problems, but I think because I've got nostalgia for it, I can kind of overlook them. And, in the ways that I still like Superman 4 like I did when I was a kid, even though that's not a good film either, but this is better than Superman 4 like. But yeah, it's not got a groundbreaking plot or anything, but the cartoon never did it, so
yeah.
I think that's a great point and great comparison to Superman 4, because that is another movie. So we had this on VHS growing up as well, and I watched it till the tape was ready to break. And the same with Superman 4. And it wasn't until I was much older that I realized anyone thought of these as bad movies. And you're right. This is better than Superman 4.
Yeah. It's better than Batman and Robin. But
I enjoy it more. I think we could argue about which is actually closer to different versions of the source material.
Yeah.
But it's, I think, definitely a more enjoyable, more coherent movie. I think actually, given some of the things that the plot asks this movie to do, it does it very coherently. So, especially when you think about new elements introduced from the Cosmic Key that hadn't been in the animated series. To the time travel element that, so people were so fond of in the 80s with the success of Back to the Future, towards the end. And I just thought it did a lot of these things really well for the story that it was telling. Now, you mentioned Dolph Lundgren, and he just looks like He-Man. He seems like He-Man. My buddy Eric Holtzman and his podcasting partner, Peter Vera, have a show, Straight Outta Gotham. I don't know if you guys have listened to that, but they, on their Twitter feed, and I think their Facebook group, had asked people to sort of say, outside of Batman, what's an IP you'd like to be seen made into a major motion picture? And they had the caveat that it couldn't already have been one. And I said, Masters of the Universe anyway. And I said, I'm going to get around.
You're a rebel. That's all. Just do it.
Yeah, man. And I'm going to get around your rule by saying I want an adaptation of the animated series, because the movie was not that. And he said, okay, well, who would you cast? And I almost said Dolph Lundgren still, because
if you did an older He-Man, you could do it.
You sure could.
Call it King He-Man, like they're doing King, with Conan. Yeah. They're supposed to be doing with Conan.
Exactly, man. He was just so well cast, and especially for a guy that hadn't done a ton of acting, and you can find out a lot of information about how often they had to redub his lines because of his thick Swedish accent still. But man, that guy, he looked like the perfect live action He-Man. And I don't know who you could cast in that role today that would be any better than he was in 1987. Chris Hemsworth's already Thor. So outside of that, I don't know where else to go.
And that was
Liam Hemsworth.
Somebody asked me, a friend of mine asked me recently, about who would you cast? Well, I'm like, okay. Thor is off the table. Now I'm blanking. Chris Hemsworth is off the table because he's Thor, and now he's going to play Hulk Hogan. So he's gone. Unless he pulls a Ryan Reynolds and decides, hey, I'm going to play 3 comic book or superheroes in one go. But Liam was another one that I thought of. But aside from the Hemsworth brothers, let's call it, there's really nobody that sticks out in my head and says, yeah, that guy is He-Man. You know, like I can do that with a Batman actor. I can do that with Superman if somebody, you know.
Yeah.
But I can't do that with He-Man. And just to what you guys were saying about Dolph Lundgren, I mean, when you look at him, and I rewatched this last night, and I'm like, aside from the fact that his hair is long, like it looks nothing like the cartoon's hair, but aside from that, he's blonde.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks like he walked off the screen of the cartoon with a a quote unquote modernish hairstyle for the time, but he was He-Man, and the voice. I get that the cartoon didn't have an accent. I fully understand that, but it never bothered me back then. And it doesn't bother me now. Like, it just, to me, that is not a deal breaker. And again, He-Man is not some, you know, efficient talker who spouts Shakespeare, you know, ad nauseum in the cartoon. So the fact that he doesn't really say much in this movie didn't really bother me. And it kind of doesn't now. Like,
I agree. Yeah, I agree entirely.
I got what I wanted. He held the sword up high and said, I have the power.
Yeah, and he you know, looks like yeah. left the house. You know? He looks like he could really push over those giant statues. I mean, the dude looks like the character. Yeah. He had longer blonde hair. It wasn't a page boy cut, but it was kind of 80s rocker cut. And man, he had the armor. He had the sword. He didn't transform from Prince Adam, but I always kind of, you know, as I got older and watched it on VHS and over the years, I just kind of had this sort of story that played off in my head where, you know, in this war with Skeletor, that secret identity had already been exposed and there was no need for it.
I never thought of it that way. I just thought he's turned from Prince Adam into He-Man. Because the film kind of, I was saying it's Adam off air, but the film kind of starts and it's like, it's almost like with Mr. Real. And it's like, it just goes straight into everything that's happening.
Right.
So I feel like in my head, I was thinking, well, he's turned into He-Man and he hadn't had a chance to turn back and he don't get a chance to turn back till the film's over. That was my sort of headcanon on that. But I think I like yours better, actually, that exposed.
I like that headcanon of yours, Garrett. That's pretty good.
I
think I'm going to borrow that from now on.
Think it's a shame that Dolph Lundgren didn't get to do this like 2 or 3 years after. Because I think his acting got better as he, you know, like I was talking to Adam about it. So have you seen that film Dark Angel that he did?
No, I think it's called...
It's called I Come in Peace in the States. I don't know if.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with that. I don't think I've seen it, but I know I can actually kind of picture the image of the movie poster, like what the old VHS clamshell looked like on the rental rental shelves.
But he's much better in that, basically, and he's got his accent down and he's got more of a screen presence than he has in this. I think because this was like such an early film for him, I think the screen presence isn't quite there. But I think the director knew that, and I think that's why he kind of got around his weaknesses, if you get with the cast that he had, like the rest of the cast.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I overall, like, he I hate to keep using this ideology, but he checked the boxes that he needed to check for me as He-Man.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was not a detriment to the movie.
It's funny, because the guys who did the toys, they hated him, didn't they? They thought he was too skinny, which I didn't get, because he don't look skinny to me in it.
If I look like the way he looks like now,
but at the same time, that's almost like what somebody actually that size looks like. They don't look like they're on steroids, do they? Do you know, like the cartoon does.
It's like I look at it like this, like it's like saying, well, Superman and Batman don't look like Ed McGuinness's art. Well, naturally, no human being is.
Exactly. Nobody has fists that large.
Yeah. So, I mean, that complaint is like, really? Like, that's where we're going?
Or a 20 pack, not a 6 pack.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But so for me, He-Man and Dolph Lundgren, I thought he did a fine job and again, checked all the boxes. I think, without a shadow of a doubt, for me, and Garrett touched on it at the beginning a little bit earlier, the performance of the movie was Frank Langella as Skeletor.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
so good.
He, without doing, you know, without basically, you know, mimicking the voice of the cartoon or the laugh or anything like that. It doesn't have that, but everything else in terms of core character motivation and just presence, he's got it all. And the translated look, I think the live action adaptation of his look is far scarier than what you see in the cartoon. And you know, I've got to love Frank Langella's reasoning for doing this, because his son loved the property so much that he had to take the part. So I really, you know, admire him for doing that. And he put his all into that performance, despite the fact that, you know, like he could have phoned it in and just went paint by the numbers, because, you know, to quote, you know, another movie, we're making a cartoon, right?
Right.
So yeah, he could have phoned it in, but he didn't. And I really appreciate that aspect of it. And if you listen to him talk in interviews about the movie, he was really looking forward to doing the final fight sequence with Dolph Lundgren, but then I think a lot of it was the stunt double.
It was, you know, interestingly enough, the final fight was filmed, I want to say, a month after filming.
Yeah, they shut it down on the cannon. Yeah.
Yeah, and they, so Cannon had shut it down, and Gary Goddard had begged the studio to let him come back in and film an ending for the movie, but the sets had already started to be deconstructed. So they had, basically, that's why the lighting changes to being so backlit and shadowed.
Yeah.
So they had some remaining pieces they could act around. But actually, the actor that played Blade, Anthony DeLongis,
he was in the Skeletor. Yeah.
Yeah, he was the one who was in the Skeletor costume.
He did all the sword stuff, didn't he? That's why he was that swordsman character, wasn't he, as well?
And you know what, though? I got to say, despite knowing that fact about, you know, they filmed it after the fact, and it was in the dark on purpose because they had no money left.
I still
enjoyed the hell out of that third act scene. I'm sorry, but I do.
Yeah, me too.
You know,
as a kid, that was always my favorite part, when they it's like, let this be our final battle, and that way I was always like, and it's because goosebumps.
The sword play was always one of my, like, I was obsessed with He-Man's sword as a child.
Oh, who wasn't? So, yeah.
I mean, that's not a shock to anybody. Like you just said, yeah, that's not a shock to anybody. If I had the money, I'd make a replica of the actual sword from the thing.
I used to have one as a kid, a glow in the dark one, but
I'm talking about if I had the money, I'd make an actual replica, but
yeah.
Sadly, the lottery, I haven't won the lottery yet. It's still, you know, I'm still trying, but I haven't gotten that far yet. But, you know, so I love that final fight, despite of like the issue that was the issue for them. Like, they made it work, and I think it gets the job done. But again, like I said, Frank Langella was 100% on point in this role.
I honestly think he's up there with the best movie villains of all time, and I'm not just saying that. I think
he's up there. Yeah, I would agree.
And he's performing. He can tell he loved playing. I think he said that was still his favorite part he's ever done, didn't he, as well? Yeah, so.
He has said that.
And that puts a smile on my face, because, you know, there are some times where you hear actors that have been part of these kind of franchises that, after the fact, they're like, "Oh, I couldn't stand doing it," and you know, they're very anti about it after the fact. I love the fact that he still loves it.
Yeah,
like, that just brings a smile to my face.
He was originally gonna, you know, look more like the cartoon with it, because he was quite in shape at the time, as well. He said on that interview I saw, and some of the ideas he had for the original makeup was really gonna look really cool. But I mean, I think it looks cool anyway, but. Mm-hmm. It would have looked probably even cooler if they'd have had more money, basically.
Right. But no,
I don't get what happened to the money, because they stole all the money from Superman 4 for this. It's like, well, what the... how did you not have any money left at the end? I mean, it looks good, doesn't it, this film, actually?
Did they spend it on that chicken? Like, maybe they... I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, movies executives in the 80s, I'm guessing a lot of it went up their nose, but I don't want to get guys in trouble for any slander.
Yeah, let's just leave that where...
Well, do you know what I think worked better for this than Superman 4, which they kind of had similar problems, was that this had a director who could deal with the problems better. And he made this film still look like $1 million, basically, where the Superman 4 director was just out of his depth with a film like that. I mean, a good director, but he just wasn't a good director for a film of that, you know, that caliber.
And just, I'll get to Gary Goddard in a second. I just want to finish a thought on Frank Langella. After the fact, I didn't know this, obviously, when I was watching the film on the initial go. But knowing after the fact that he would later play two characters that are also important to my fandom. So he played, obviously, Perry White in Superman Returns, which the moment that was announced, I'm like, oh, Skeletor is Superman's boss. That's going to be interesting. Because that's how my mind processes these things. So you can imagine my mind when I go see Deadpool and it's like, but it's also a Green Lantern and I'm confused. But no, so he played, Perry White, but he also at one time played Zorro, and Zorro is another favorite of mine. So I just think in general, Frank Langella is pretty awesome. So
he played Dracula as well.
Yeah,
he
did. There you go.
Yeah, he's the Hammer films.
Yeah. He really likes wearing a cape, apparently.
He's all over the genre stuff. And I think if you look at one of the Langella's strengths of an actor is he plays things very real. Even in a fantastical setting or something that could turn camp, Langella plays it straight, and there is a seriousness in his delivery, and it's all over his interpretation of Skeletor. He transforms the villain into something richer than I think it would have been in the hands of a number of other actors. And I think you got to give Gary Goddard credit for that too. And just in the casting here, because he plays this character as, you know, somebody, he says it, you know, he's waited so very long, and you get, you feel that weight, in this sort of ages of battle and the thirst for power and sort of the isolation and that thirst of power in a lot of his delivery. I think he just does such a good job making this a real character and not just presenting a villain on screen. So you can't really say enough good things about his performance here.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And again, kudos to Gary Goddard for putting up with all the stuff that he put up with. And definitely, I think, making the best of the situation, for sure. I mean, it could have been... who knows how worse off this film could have been in another director's hands. Because I think, like I said, he put the best foot forward with all the stuff that he was dealing with and such. But one of the things that I think is a negative to the film is, I mean, it's the Man at Arms role is cast well because he looks like the character from the
series.
But the dynamic between him and Tila is just, it doesn't work for me. Like the whole father-daughter routine. And there's a couple times in the film where they try and play it up, but it falls a little flat for me. What did you guys think of that whole aspect of it?
You go first, Garrett.
You know, for me, I can't say I ever really had a problem with it, but I think, you know, depending on where you're comparing it to, I can see that. So, you know, in the animated, in the Filmation series, you sort of get a Tila that is growing up, and she can be headstrong and wants to learn about her past and doesn't always follow, you know, her dad's advice. But in the movie, it's a little bit more... adversarial isn't the right word, but it's sort of like, oh, it's like, oh, my old man. Oh, yeah. You know, oh, you're thinking with your stomach. Oh, how barbaric you did this to me. But I, you know, John Cypher played Man at Arms, and you're right. Like he really had a mustache that gets you a ways there. But I kind of liked him as this sort of battle hardened, you know, it's been into war and seen it character. But yeah, it was a little bit of a different approach to the father-daughter dynamics. You didn't get the feel that Tila had the same sort of reverence for her dad as she did in the series. So yeah, I can understand the dissonance, but I thought, you know, for the context of the movie itself, it worked fine. You know, would I choose to have it different? Yeah, maybe I would in future iterations, but you know, I thought both actors for the two parts did a nice job. And Chelsea Field played Tila, and I don't remember if I've seen her really do much else after that, at least that I didn't recognize, that I recognized at the time.
No, I don't think she did out big after this.
And that wasn't, I was, you know, Man-at-Arms looked a lot more like Man-at-Arms than Teela looked like Teela, but you know, yeah. for the way they were using the story, I thought it it did the job it needed to do.
Yeah, she did a solid job, and I like the fact that she had that big moment where she comes and basically, you know, saves the boys, if you will. I think it's close to the third act. It was in the rest of the chicken. No, it was, sorry, not the chicken place. I'm obsessed with the chicken place.
That chicken thing. Yeah. She goes, what are these little white sticks? Like, what does she think they are? That's what I just do not get.
Right. What
put these food on these? I was like, it tasted good. I'm like, come here and eat anything.
But you know the film, you gotta love when this is the controversy we're talking about in the film and not something else, because there's so many films where there's more controversies nowadays. I gotta say, I really did like the portrayal of Evil in here, especially
Meg Foster. Yeah, she's
brilliant. Yeah, yeah. The part where I was really sold was when she was pretending to be Courtney Cox's mother,
and then
right at the end she transforms back. And like the voice changes in the whole 9 yards. I'm like, right then and there in that moment, that's Evil in, like, to a T. I thought it was never, what I liked about it was that it was a matter of fact performance. It wasn't over the top, which I guess, you know, she kind of had to be to play off, because you're playing off what Frank Langella is doing. And I just, I really liked that portrayal, and I would have liked to see, if I had my way, I would have liked to see it fleshed out a bit more. But given the context of what she was asked and what was in the script, and I thought she did a fantastic job. So just to get quick thoughts from you guys on Evelyn.
Well, did you know originally they wanted Sarah Douglas?
I had heard that too.
Yeah. But
that would be kind of on the nose, wouldn't you think?
Yeah,
that?
I think that's what I think they went with Meg Foster as well, because I think Gary Goddard did talk about, because she's got amazing eyes, aren't she, Meg Foster? Right?
Yeah.
Her eyes are like no one else's in the world, basically. I absolutely love her in it. I think my favorite part is actually when she leaves at the end, because she's like, Skeletor's not winning this one. So she
beat me to it. You beat me to it. That's exactly what I was
so Evelyn, isn't it? She just doesn't. Yeah. She's always out for herself, isn't it? Even. Because when she goes to Earth to get back the three, the assassins that are not very good, should we say? She's kind of almost like the boss, like.
Yeah.
So it's to me, I feel like she's kind of like, it's a little bit like, I mean, it has been compared to New Gods on it, which is not unintentional, because Gary Goddard was a big Jack Kirby fan, but she's very much like the Granny Goodness in a sense, like she's. She kind of leads the armies, but in this, it's almost like where she's afraid of Skeletor. I think she's more like she'd turn on him if she got chance, I think, basically.
Yeah.
Power, so.
That's one of my favorite parts of this portrayal, is sort of the through line of that character through the movie, where she seems, you know, almost in love with Skeletor at the beginning. Yeah. And he says, you know, one of her first lines is that, you know, finally, after all this time, Grayskull is ours. And he says, no, mine. And then,
yeah, that's
and
such then, a good moment, that.
And, you, and it's like sort of this little tear that throughout the movie gets wider and wider. She sees, she is trying to relate with Skeletor as her equal or her partner, and he keeps reminding her that that is not the case.
Yeah.
You know, she speaks up kind of on behalf of the assassins after they get their butts kicked. The henchmen come back defeated, and he says, well, guess what? You're going out with them. And she's like, well, that's not what I was saying. And he's like, well, I don't care. Go to and then that sort of gap keeps broadening until the end, where it's clear that Skeletor, you know, it's either the feelings have changed or he is not going to win. She pulls back the troops and leaves him to kind of his doom. I thought that was just a really interesting thing, and not something that the movie had to do, right? Like, there's what I really appreciate is there's these little bits of richness that didn't have to be included, that you can tell real thought went into these characters. Mm-hmm. For a cheap canon 80s movie, they didn't need to think about it that much, but the filmmakers did, and the actors did a nice job with it. And, you know, I appreciate that. And that's my kind of Evelyn thought.
Yeah.
I think if you look at canon films as well, I mean, I've seen a lot of canon films over the years, but none of them look as good as this film. This film looks like, he really used the money, didn't he, basically, to make it look.
Yeah, like he wrung every cent out of each dollar.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, he did such a good job with it. And like even the special effects, I think still a lot of them still hold up now.
Yeah, you know, they're not horrible. I've seen better fake flying.
When he's on that
in my life, '87 on a low budget. I mean, you can't tell me that this. And of course, there's years that separate it. But prior to the special editions in Star Wars, I've seen stuff that looked just as bad in Empire Strikes Back when you can see through the cockpit of the X-Wings, you know, on the battle on Hoth. You know, it's when you're layering images back in the 80s, before you got to digital, things could look worse than they look in Masters of the
Universe.
I mean, since we're on the visuals and the special effects, what I'll say is I love the look of you know, that first shot of Castle Grayskull. And then...
it was a matte painting, wasn't it, that they used? Yeah,
but it was gorgeous. Like Garrett said, the perfect word was gorgeous. And then the interior, the throne room, was like, it looked so. It had that majestic, you know, that you'd expect from it.
Yeah, and it feels big as well, doesn't it? It don't feel like a small thing. It's
and it does transport you to another world when you're watching the film. So my only caveat is that. I love the aesthetic of you know, those scenes that, you know, all things being equal, I wish we could have seen more of that world. I mean, that's the drawback of the situation that happened, is that we couldn't see more of that. But I think what they could show us and what they did show us looked visually stunning.
So the throne room in Grayskull was at the time one of the largest, if not the largest, sound stages that had been constructed in decades. They actually tore down a wall to build two of them together.
Yeah.
And then, you know, went through the process of a lot of what you see inside of Grayskull was physically built set. Yeah. Had some matte paintings, you know, did obviously with the Eye of Grayskull, which was a new addition. You know, there are some things that they did special effect wise that weren't necessarily in camera, but there's a lot of production you see that was real world physical in those shots.
Right. Yeah. It's like I said, it just looks, what they did show us looked stunning, which was great while watching the movie, but then, you know, the drawback is, damn, I wish we could have seen more.
because if the budget had been bigger, what did
it? You do see some, like I don't know if you've seen Garrett. There is concept art that you see in documentaries and certain things where it's like, man, that would have looked great if they were able to realize that and so yeah, it's but what they did show us, I think you have to give a special shout out to, and again. You know, I think it was Steven that mentioned there is a certain, you know, with the vehicles that you know, Skeletor and his crew are using in, you know, once they arrive on Earth, it does have a New Gods feel. It's like a combination of New Gods meets Star Wars, which, you know, I guess if you're gonna borrowing from Star Wars at the time was the obvious choice, right?
He wanted Kirby to do some concept art for it originally. I don't actually know when Jack Kirby died. Did he die in the 80s or was it? Was it the 90s that he died?
I'm not sure.
I can't remember. Well, anyway, somehow he couldn't do it. And he actually dedicated the film to him. And then Canon took the credit out for some reason.
Yeah, Kirby died in 94. And
was in 94, yeah.
Yeah, Goddard wanted to make it very obvious that he was getting influence from Kirby. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think Canon was worried about rights and if that opened up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Say it was a source material type thing and other financial cuts. They don't want to go get into that whole ball of wax.
Yeah, there's a lot of misconception that it was a New God script and that it repurposed and it wasn't. I think people have kind of misinterpreted what Goddard said in the past about the New God's influence, basically.
Yeah, but no, but
it could work as a New God's film, couldn't it? When you actually think about it, the whole thing about getting the power and all that sort of stuff, it's very, that could be like the anti-life equation and all that sort of stuff. You think?
Right. But no, I think the comparison and the desire to sort of echo that from Gary Goddard's point of view, it works with the property, and you know, it's also kind of in keeping what we saw with the animated series, because the animated series was that balance of, you know, futuristic technology mixed with some sword and sandals kind of stuff. And so, you know, I thought that was definitely carried over into the film. So yeah, I definitely appreciated the visual choices that they made.
What and I'll this? Say on that front, sorry, just a, one no. one thing that I rewatching it stood out to me again was just how much that mix is there. So if you go to, and if you've watched The Toys That Made Us on Netflix or
yeah, movies, I watched that, yeah.
I think I Have the Power, the Definitive History of Masters of the Universe is another.
That's a different document. Yeah, that's on Netflix as well. Like,
I've seen that one, but yeah, so I think it's different. Yeah.
They both go into pretty good detail about how when the toy line creators at Mattel were standing up this toy line and talking about the backstory, the fusion of sort of barbarian sword and sandals plus sci-fi and those elements really being there together was a core concept that was important to the series. And while the Filmation series, you had your blasters and you had some higher tech vehicles and things like that, you didn't see like this disparity between the gruff barbarian sword and sandals mystical magical plus technology in the same way the early concept art and the early mini comics early 8-back and 4-back cardstock had. And in this movie, I think it's really there quite a bit. You see, it's not called the Power Sword, but you see He-Man's sword in sort of like the little lockdown next to the throne with the high-tech lights blinking like it's like science and magic. Like they're meeting and like the scientific technology elements are draining the power from the sword. And as Meg Foster's Evil Lyn is knelt down before Skeletor on the throne, he has his hands on the side of her head, and you see he has some cybernetic lights on the gloves, almost as if the technology is built into him. And that stood out to me. I'm like, wow, this does a better job of that than the Filmation series did, because the old school stuff is pretty cool and pretty unique. And you know, as we all know, the mini comics went sort of developed to be more in the Filmation universe. So you can see sort of the key differences of this wasn't the Filmation, this was closer to the original concepts.
Yeah. Good point.
What did you guys think of the Stormtroopers then? Because obviously they did that because the He-Man wasn't allowed to kill anyone, was he? So they kind of had these sort of dark Stormtrooper looking guys that
it's almost as if they took the Horde Troopers, you know, from She-Ra and gave him a black painting and said, oh no, these are Skeletors now.
I just need to mention one thing that made me laugh. Do you know the scene on the rooftop where Skeletor gets He-Man to give up? Yeah. If you're watching when they're all piling on him, one of them just like spears into him, right? And he's like, he falls over. It's absolutely hilarious. And he just sort of slips. He's going after him and ends up between his legs.
Yeah. I never had any problem with it. I just thought, whatever we can get for He-Man to, you know, to use weaponry on, I'm cool with. Like, whatever excuse you have to give me to make that happen, you know, to make it okay for the powers that be, so be it. But I do want to touch on, before we get to our favorite moment, you know, action moment of the film, I do want to touch on your thoughts on the human story in terms of Courtney Cox and all that aspect. Because I know that in more recent movies, when a franchise, for example, you take a look at Green Lantern, it gets derided for spending too much time on Earth and, you know, wasting time on the more human story. So what do you think of the that aspect of the film? Do you think would you have wished it wasn't there entirely? Did you like it? What's your feelings on that? So Garrett, what did you think?
You know, I think I can see where people would say that's not what I was looking for. It's not really what I would want out of a Masters of the Universe movie. But I think it was, for what they chose to do, it was done well. Mm-hmm. I'm actually impressed with how early in her acting career Courtney Cox was. And she, I thought she did a very good job portraying Julie. And you feel the pain. I don't see her you see her as a character, not necessarily as an actress reading lines with a lot of young actors. That's sort of what they're doing still. They haven't honed their craft, but yeah. I think it's believable. you do feel, at least the emotional connective lines were there for me, and you felt her pain, you felt the struggle between her and Kevin, and how to grow up, and the prospect of them separating and their lives. And then I think for a movie that needed to spend time on Earth for budgetary reasons, it sort of gave an interesting point of view character for the audience that might not been, and probably maybe what they're trying to do is for those that weren't already, you know, dyed in the wool fans of the franchise, give them a point of view character to experience this sort of craziness and zaniness of an invading Eternian army and this band of heroes trying to save not just their planet, but ours. And you know, do I want that for the, if we ever, you know, to your point, if we're 94 and the next live action movie comes out? No, I don't. But for this movie, I thought they did a nice job, and I'm not annoyed by it, right? Like I appreciate it for what it is. And I think the actors did a nice job with what they're given to portray.
Steven, what's your thought on it?
Yeah, I was always okay when I was a kid. I think as a kid, I found the Earth bits a little bit, I won't say boring, but I kind of wanted to get past those parts a little bit. But I think Robert McNeil as Kevin is really good in it as well. So I think when you've got actors that can hold the scene and stuff, that helps. And for me, the best character on Earth is Lubick, you know, like James Tolkien from Back to the Future and Back to the Future, principle, 80s movies. Yeah, I absolutely love that guy. And there's bits of his what I think absolutely steal the movie as well, to be honest, because he just.
I like when he stays there at the end. That's the best part.
I'm like, where did he meet this woman? At the end, he just goes, "I'm gonna have a retirement."
It's in a cutscene. We have to release the extended cut of Master.
Well, I almost wonder, because I know Cannon had a habit of cutting the scripts down during production. I almost wonder if some stuff got cut and you would have seen a bit more and all this sort of thing. But anyway, it's kind of cool that he's that kind of cool. He's like a bit of an a-hole cop, isn't he? But at the same time, he's still kind of like cool, and he ends up helping him out at the end with his shotgun and stuff. So I always liked him. One of the things about the Earth scene that always got me, though, was when Courtney Cox is in that, you know, like that high school thing, and she's crawling under tables. And I always just thought how lame the assassins were. They couldn't even kill this Earth. you know, a slim Earth woman who probably wouldn't have been any bother for anyone else. And they just can't seem to do anything to her. And that guy with swords misses. I'm like, he's supposed to be my expert swordsman.
That happens in a lot of movies where expert shots are firing way off.
Classic.
But, it's the classic trope. But no, I was fine with it. And like you said, like Garrett was saying, I think for being that age, Courtney Cox was already really solid as a performer. Yeah. And so she sold all the emotions that she needed to sell. And I think, you know, for me, I kind of liked the part about, I know it's cliche and you kind of could see it coming, but the fact that when they're sent back home, she has a chance to correct the accident that took her parents from her. I, you know what? Is it cheesy? Yeah. Did I roll with it and did I enjoy it? Sure.
Yeah. Who doesn't love a happy ending? Come on.
Right.
I always love a happy ending. People moan about them, and I'm like, I like happy endings.
I like to feel good. And you know, it's crazy. The older I've gotten, and I think it's part of being a dad now too. I don't have a lot of energy to spend on entertainment that leaves me feeling down or depressed. Like I want to watch something that's entertaining because I feel good and I enjoy it, not because it's like, oh man, I'm gonna wrestle with that one for the next 2 weeks about it. You know, I don't know.
For me, the only people's parents that have to die are Uncle Ben and Bruce Wayne's parents. Beyond that, we can have a conversation.
Well, technically Superman's as well, you know.
I was gonna say,
the
Jor-El and Lara gotta go.
Jor-El and Lara, and the whole planet. But I digress. But aside from that grouping, everybody else is fair game to keep him alive, in my opinion. But all right, so let's touch on our favorite action sequence from the film.
Are we all gonna have the same one here?
Probably.
We'll just, you know what? I'm gonna throw a curveball to try and make sure that we don't. And I will say the attack on the high school gym is what I will go with. And I'll speak to its merits, but I'm trying to be unique here. I think what I enjoyed as a kid and what I enjoyed watching it over the years, and again, you know, just getting ready to talk with you guys, was it's this like burst of energy when the henchmen break in and, you know, Beastman hits the janitor through the door, and he's, you know, he's facing one direction and one side of the door, and he comes flying through it headfirst on the other. It's kind of goofy, but it's high paced, it's fast action.
The music's good as well. The music's great.
it's loud. It's confusing. It is, you know, because Courtney Cox does such a good job, you believe that she is in danger and that she's very scared. And then He-Man shows up, right? And that the battle starts to turn, and very quickly, you know, you sort of make short work of the henchmen. And for me, as a kid, that was just so exciting because it's the first real battle, you know, besides Gwildor's getting broken. But it's the first real battle of the film. And that was just so cool to see on screen. And I think it was pretty effectively pulled off, besides the fact that, you know, oh man, I can't get beneath these folding tables to get this girl. But, you know, it was exciting. It was adventurous. And it was great to see those characters in a real battle, live action, for the first time.
Yeah, that's actually a good one. And the explanation works.
Yeah. If it, I'm a huge like horror fan as well, so I thought that bit felt very horror movie. So I was, I've always liked that. I think as a kid, you like being a bit scared as well, don't you?
Yeah, especially like 80s high school horror movie. It's got the letter jacket and everything.
Yeah. For me, it was obviously the sort of it in the end. We already touched on this, so I'm not going to rehash. But when Skeletor comes to Earth and there's a scene where they're all chasing down He-Man and you know. And our crew of heroes, because of the vehicles and you know all that stuff, you know, the Kirby-esque elements, I really found that entertaining and invigorating. So I'll go with that one. And I just, like I said, visually it looked keep in mind for 1987.
Yeah,
it looked really good.
I like as well in that. I remember as a kid, you know, when He-Man keeps on fighting. When they've got him, and there's like 1,000 stormtroopers coming.
Yeah.
I like that he kept on fighting, because as a kid, you got really excited, didn't it? And then Skeletor's like, enough, because he's just had enough of it, hasn't he?
And the only reason he stops fighting is to save everybody else, right? So he doesn't look weak at all in that scene.
No, not at all, no.
By getting captured. So that's, you know, I really liked that moment of the film.
And you got to think of Skeletor as well. He's a man of his word, isn't he? It's just, he lets them stay on Earth. Just as...
Yeah, until they invade his
yeah, then thing. He's like, all bets are off.
All bets are off. What about you, Stephen?
I'm gonna go back to the final fight, but I'm going to go just to the little bit before. So, you know, the moments where I love the moments when Skeletor's basically getting the power, and he's, although I wouldn't want to wear that headdress. If that's what you got to be a god, I'd rather not be one. it must have been weird to turn that. But I like just the bit where He-Man gets his sword back. I just, as a kid, you're waiting for it, and it goes on a bit, doesn't it? It's quite dramatic because he's like firing electricity at him in a cat. And then he does the I have the power line, which is what you're waiting for as a kid, innit, all the time. But I like the actual end of the fight as well, when he actually falls down the what would you call it?
Bottomless chamber.
That was cool. And I always remember when he fell, because his hood comes off, doesn't it? And you actually see all his head. I always thought it was quite cool.
Right.
But yeah, that whole sequence was just my favorite as a kid. And the whole film builds up to that moment as well.
I love it.
And like you said before about the budget thing, I never even noticed that they'd up to shooting like that because of budget.
And even watching it last night, I was like, I don't care that they had no budget to film this. I still love this.
No, it kind of works because that thing expands back out, doesn't it? Oh, it like closes, and then it's like the lights come back on. It's like, it kind of works.
It does work. They made it work in the movie. I thought that was fantastic. I love when, you know, Skeletor just kneel, and he's blasting him, and He-Man doesn't kneel, and he reaches out, and he doesn't get the sword, and he reaches out again, and he does it in the third one.
Yeah.
He gets it, pulls it up, and the score comes in, and it's just a great, great moment. And then,
well, I think we can all agree the score is brilliant in this film.
Oh, it's really, phenomenal.
Really well done. Really well done. And then, you know, even to the point you mentioned when Skeletor falls, the look on He-Man's face is not like, got him. You know, that's the one dead dude. I beat him. It's like, yeah, you know, yeah. He sort of has this look like, I didn't want it to have to go this way. Yeah, you know, it's just like very true to the character. And
yeah, if
I
he think, would have been smiling and, you know, winking, then it would have been a little bit, yeah, out of care. Yeah, no.
That's the point.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, in a lot of aspects, this movie is much better than it has any right to be on paper. And yeah. That's why people have, you know, consistently enjoyed it. And it takes some shots here and there, but it's kept some dedicated fans for like, what, 34 years since it went into production.
It's been holding the torch while we wait for the next one.
Oh, man.
By the way, I saw that post-credit scene where Skeletor says, "I'll be back" last night. And I'm like, that's a lie.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my god, how long do those credits go on for though? I remember as a kid used to be waiting, you'd be like, oh my god, we'll just get to the end bit. And as a kid, you don't understand why there wasn't a second one, do you? Like, well, why are they not doing another one? You don't realize, like, when you're a kid, that films have budgets and they have to make money back basically to get sequels and all this sort of stuff.
And it's funny because I had a flashback to this scene when I was in the theater watching Green Lantern, and Sinestro puts on the yellow ring.
Yeah, and then that never happened again.
Watching that on Blu-ray, you know, a while back, I'm like, damn it, they did it to me again. I got fooled again.
Now, I've got a question for you, Bob.
HBO Max, not that long ago, and I had the same sort of thought. And again, it's like, great actor, really well cast in the role, executed it well, and then, you know, an unfulfilled promise at the end.
You know, there's a lot of similarities, actually, when you think about it, isn't there? I don't think there's anything wrong with any of the Green Lantern cast, to be honest. It's just not...
No.
Yeah, it just doesn't quite hit the mark, does it?
Yeah, there's...
Is this the first film that had an a post-credit scene, like, ever? Because I've struggled to find one before it, when I've looked.
I think Ferris Bueller's Day Off would have been 1 year earlier.
Oh, yeah.
At the very end.
Bueller's Day Off,
Here, you know, leave, go home.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, and then Deadpool kind of did a riff on that.
That does kind of go through the credits, though, doesn't it? Because you see the teacher getting on the bus, doesn't he? So.
Yeah, it kind of continues on through
the credits.
So before we do our final thought and rating, there's two things I have to mention. One, I think we can all agree that Gwildor is basically... a cheaper version to do than Orko. I mean, that's
I've got to mention something about Gwildor, right? Yeah. The best bit is when he goes on about, we can wear these as disguises, and then Kevin goes, what the hell is that? And he goes, see, it works.
Native clothing.
That was pretty funny. Or when he comes in with a car and it's like, look, native transportation, but I souped it up. It's, you know, basically, he's like...
Now it runs on neutrinos.
I wonder what the rights are with Gwildor. I wonder if they could technically use him in a cartoon or something, because Canon Films don't exist anymore, does it? So,
well, they did use Gwildor in the most recent miniseries.
They did. Yep.
And he's in that Toffees game, isn't he, as well? Yeah.
And that's the other thing I wanted to mention, was the MacGuffin of the film, the key, is also in that book.
Is it? Oh, that's cool. Did you even notice it just looks like a pineapple, doesn't it?
A little bit. Yeah, now that you mentioned. But yeah, you know what I think was, I guess they couldn't, or could, you know what would have been cool in hindsight, is if the musical cue that the key played was the theme for the animated series. That would have been cool. Like a bar from the...
Yeah,
but I'm like, well, that was, you know, unfortunate that it wasn't. But I like that those two aspects of the film.
See, that was clever though, wasn't it? That the tune, because he has to recreate the tune on the keyboard, does Kevin? That's quite clever though, way of doing it, wasn't it? Because then when he did the tune and these things that happen to need, I've got one on my arm right here.
you know,
you go with it, don't you? But it's kind of cool that, you know. The tune was what the kind of opens the gate to the, you know, to jump into another time zone or whatever, or universe.
Yeah, no, it's a cool little MacGuffin there that they used. But I guess now comes the hard part is final thought and giving this thing a rating.
Well, do you think, before we do, do we just talk a little bit about what the sequel was going to be, and then?
Oh yeah,
because we're going to do a sequel, but because I think the problem with this film is it came out when He-Man's popularity was starting to kind of dwindle. I think that's pretty much what, and obviously things like the showings. I know they had some problems, didn't they, showing it at certain times and stuff, because Canon Films were a bit dodgy and weren't paying cinemas and stuff and all that kind of crap. So they'd only put it on at certain times. And so basically it was set up to fail before it even came out. But they were going to do a sequel, and it was going to be on Earth again. We're going to go back to Earth. Yeah. So, and He-Man was going to return to Earth to fight Skeletor. And apparently, Skeletor was supposed to turn Earth into an apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic wasteland. So I imagine time travel would have been involved again. And apparently She-Ra was supposed to be in it as well. So that would have been quite interesting.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
But the Globus and Golan of Canon Films blamed Dolph Lundgren for why the film failed. Idiots. So yeah, that we're going to cast this guy called Lade Hamilton, who was
a surfer.
Yeah, and he had less acting experience than Dolph Lundgren. He'd been in one film called North Shore. So I don't get why you would think, right, Dolph Lundgren's the problem, so we're going to get someone who's got even less acting experience. It just doesn't add up to me.
Well, and the storyline was also He-Man was going to go back to Earth undercover as a professional football player in a post-apocalyptic landscape. So you're going to hire a dude that was a pro surfer.
Is that like the reverse of Flash Gordon?
Yeah, it is. Exactly. That's exactly it. You know?
Good Lord.
80s movie.
But I think we dodged a bullet. They were going to film it simultaneously with the Spider-Man film they were going to make, sounds awful as well.
Yeah, they were going to be sharing set pieces. And Kevin and Julie were supposed to be back, and they were going to share the same high school somehow, even though they said that they were graduating with Peter and either Gwen or Mary Jane in the
New York.
They were going to share the production costs and sets. Yeah.
So they were trying to kill, let's kill three franchises as quick as we can. They killed the Superman franchise. They took out the He-Man franchise just as it started, and they were going to kill.
Do you know the irony with Superman 4? If they'd have actually put the money in, they probably wouldn't have had the first major hit and made loads of money. That was the annoying thing. But anyway, the sets got and the disclosed got reused for a Cyborg, the Van Damme vehicle, so it didn't go to waste.
Well, that depends.
Well, maybe it
is. Depends on your opinion of that film, but whatever. Yeah.
But yeah, that was the intended sequel. Yeah,
I think we can all agree, as much as we want to see another Master of the Universe, that wasn't what we wanted to see.
Yeah, we dodged a bullet.
But all right, let's get final thoughts on the movie and then give it a score. We usually do letter grades for films. So, Garrett, what are your final thoughts and letter grade?
Man, final thoughts is for somebody that loves this franchise, loves these characters, this thing holds up remarkably well. I enjoy it every time I get a chance to revisit it. This was just a nice excuse to say, you know what? I've got the time. I'm going to talk about this movie. Let's go watch it again. And, you know, for me, it's a B+. You know, there's things that could make it better. It could use a little more money. It could use a little more time on Eternia. Looking back, if this is the only live action He-Man we've gotten in, you know, a generation or more now, it would have been nice to see some more of the traditional characters, but none of that holds it back. So it's much better than average. I said this before. I think it's better than it has a right to be. It's a rock solid B+. I have a great time every time I watch it.
Awesome. For me, all I can say is that as a kid, I had fun with it, and it put a smile on my face. And when I watched it yesterday as a soon-to-be 37-year-old man, it did the exact same thing. I thought, yes, there were some things missing from the series that I would have liked to see. But at the same time, as I said earlier, they checked a lot of the boxes. And I just think that it is a... I think Garrett hits the nail on the head. It's a better movie than it probably had any right to be. And honestly, if you gave me a choice of five movies from properties that I love, and you asked me which one would you put it in if you could only choose one, this would win out if you compare it to a lot of the other quote unquote bad movies from the franchises that I love. So. So yeah, overall, I'm going to go with B+ too. I try to watch it once every year when I can, and it's just as enjoyable every time. And it makes me long for another live action film. And hopefully, like I said, before the age of 94, we can reconvene and talk about the new one. But it's a B+ for me for the 1987 Masters of the Universe. Steven?
Yeah, I mean, I can say as a kid, I didn't care. I just wanted He-Man and Skeletor, and that's what I got. And even as an adult, I kind of feel a little bit like that in some respects. I know you said you were bummed out that it didn't have Battle Cat in his
battle. Yeah, I'll always be bummed out about Battle Cat.
Yeah. But I think it's one of those films where it's got some really epic moments in it that really stand out. And like you guys have said about it, you know, being a better film than it deserved to be. I mean, I think the director is why it came out as good as it did. And
yes,
for me, he had the love for this that, like, in a way, which is weird because he said he wasn't really a fan of the He-Man like properties as well. But he had the love for like this, just making this kind of film. In a way, like Richard Donner did with Superman as well, you know. So he almost wondered if he'd have had the money and the backing with the correct studio, maybe he could have turned it into an actual franchise. But we'll never know. But yeah, I still love it now. I mean, I know it's got problems and the stuff I laugh at that's goofy in it. Like I said about the Stormtrooper guy falling over, and there's little bits of dialogue that just make me laugh. But it's just fun, entertaining. I mean, he doesn't even clock in at 2 hours, so it's not like you're ever bored as well watching it. It's got Living in a Box in it, a song from the 80s that I love as well, so I had to bring that up. but yeah, I'm with you guys. I'm just going to go over B+. I mean, I was thinking of a letter grade, and I was finding it hard to kind of sum up my thoughts, because I wouldn't compare this B+ to like a B+ of something like a good... I could give a really, really good movie a B+, and it wouldn't be on the same level, but I feel like it deserves a B+.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. The letter grade's difficult for me. I was thinking about this because I always, you know, when I go on a show and we're discussing a movie or a television show or a comic, typically you get around to grading it. And my buddy Justin has his podcast Let's Go, and they use the Let's Go scale, and the name of the show is Let's Go because it's stuff that you would tell your friends, oh man, this is really good, you should check it out, and that's Let's Go. There's a level higher than that. That's Gotta Go. And it doesn't quite get to Gotta Go. It's not the best of the absolute best, but this is something that I would tell anyone, like, Let's Go, you should see this. Like, I think you'll like it. It's something I like. So to your point, Steven, it's not like you know, I think of like, if I'm going to go with like a very formal film critic analysis, B+, but it's like B+, you will have. And you will enjoy it. It will not be a waste of your time. It won't be the best thing you ever saw, but it's something you should definitely watch. Like that's sort of exactly where it is for me.
I think if I had to use the Let's Go scale, I'd probably, and I had to tell my, like, if I was time travel, let's put time travel in it. If I time traveled back to my younger self, I'd be like, you better go see this because this is the only one we're going to get for a year.
So enjoy it.
Get your butt to the theater right now.
From that aspect, it's an absolute gotta go because you're not getting anything else.
Yeah.
So something else I was going to mention, actually, I've got my son into He-Man a little bit, so which is kind of amazing for me because he's like 3 now. When I was like 3 or 4, I was really into He-Man as well. And I put the film on the other day, and I actually had some worries thinking, oh, is he going to get scared? He didn't get scared at all of it. But he knew as soon as He-Man came on, he goes, is that He-Man? So he knows. Like I said about Dolph Lundgren looking like He-Man, he's obviously got something that tells kids that that's He-Man as well. So I was quite chuffed. My son watched a bit of it with me and enjoyed it.
You know, I'm kind of jealous of both of you in the respect that you can buy the toys now and say they're for your kids. Where when I do it, there's no excuse. No, that's for me.
Oh yeah, it's great. Oh no, I get these to play with the kids. They love it. Like, you know, meanwhile they're going, you know, we'll play with them for a little bit. Or I'll like pull out the older toys that are kind of beat up and then buy nicer ones and add to the collection.
That's hilarious. But so that's our review of Masters of the Universe. Garrett, it was a pleasure to have you on to talk about.
Yeah, thanks, guys. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
We'll have to have you back when we have. A new, either we'll have you back for one of the newer animated. I don't want to say the movie because who knows when that's going to come. If it comes, while podcasts are still a thing and we're still doing them,
we'll have to get you on Batman and Superman as well.
Yeah,
on one of those.
Well,
yeah,
we'll have to get you on one of those. Yeah, for sure.
That'd be a lot of fun.
I know you already gave your social media plug, but if you want to do it one more time, just so if people want to talk He-Man or Batman or Superman with you or fantasy football, they can do that wherever they.
Yeah, absolutely. So over on Twitter, I am at Garrett, W-A-T-O. That's G-A-R-R-E-T-W-A-T-O. I get asked the W-A-T-O. It stands for What Are the Odds? It's a fantasy football website and podcast I have with my buddies. So if you really like fantasy football, you can check me out there. Otherwise, you know, I'd love for you to read my comic reviews over at Batman on Film. And then I've got this upcoming, we're recording this on Wednesday, next Monday, I've got a podcast that's dropping on the Batman Book Club. It's my buddy Ryan's podcast.
I listened to the first episode the other day. I finally found it, and I listened to the first episode. It was really good.
Yeah, man, he kind of just grabs guests that want to talk about different books. And we are talking about Batman Earth One, which while it was a huge hit and was a bestseller, I just don't hear that much about anymore. So if people like listening to me talk about He-Man and they want to hear me talk about Batman, that will drop on Monday. But otherwise, yeah, just hit me up on social media. I love to interact, and we can chat it up about whatever you like.
Awesome. Steven, if they want to talk to you about He-Man or Superman or Batman, same stuff, where do they
go? Yeah, you can do that on Twitter at SteveBob1984. And if you want to follow the page for the podcast, it's at MMNPDC.
And thank God he remembers that, because I never do. but if you want to follow me, it's Adam_LeesFan on Twitter. And we also have the Multiverse Musings podcast Facebook page where you can ask for permission to join the group. One of us will add you and we can continue talking about He-Man or Batman or anything else geek related over there, and I'll be happy to do it. We hope you enjoyed this look back at the Masters of the Universe film. We want you to remember that we all have the power, and we want you on your next days, weeks, and months ahead to have a good journey.
Good journey.
Good journey. Love it.
So long, everybody.
Skeletor. It's over. Yes. For you.
By the power of Grayskull.